Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we hear from three distinguished poets: Derek Walcott, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1992, Robert Pinsky, a former United States Poet Laureate, and Adam Zagajewski, one of the leading new wave of Polish poets, currently a visiting professor in the Creative Writing Program at the University of Houston. After each reads a selection of politically potent poems, they will engage in a discussion about the role of poetry in politics. Tonight's event is sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University in cooperation with the Boston University Creative Writing Program and the Department of Foreign Languages and Literatures at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Moderating the discussions and introducing tonight's guests is Arina Grudzinska-Gross, the Executive Director of the Institute for Human Sciences.
My name is Irena Grudzinska-Gross, and I'm Director of Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University. And I welcome everybody at what will certainly be an unusual evening. Unusual because we have a unique occasion to listen to and ask questions of three outstanding poets: Robert Pinsky, Derek Walcott, and Adam Zagajewski, and I place them here in alphabetical order. So as I was saying, today's event is unusual because we have here the highest possible concentration of outstanding poets per square meter. And because we'll ask them questions about the topic that is usually considered too simple or simplistic, the relationship, if any, between poetry and politics. And the first to read his poems will be Derek Walcott.
This is a section from a new book called The Prodigal. This is a poem, part of a long poem. I think I look at Italy differently. I come from the Caribbean, and my history and Italy's don't connect, really. But I've been invited there often, and something is happening that is a little frightening, and that is a shift of fealty, maybe. Blessed are the small farms conjugating Horace, and the olive trees as twisted as Ovid's syntax. Virgilian twilight on the hides of cattle and the small turreted castles on the Tuscan slopes. To live in another language with the swallow's wings, Celadon beating over the rye, shadows on the barley, between the peeling farms and the rusted poplars, the bright air full of drunken insects, the pervigilium veneris, Latin words leaping to life as the train glides into dividing Florence. Outside Firenze, the hill offered itself, erect flame, cypresses, and an ochre castle, sepulchral towards evening, a star's first spark. Over the red-brown tiles of roofs, through the olive grove, dusk, delicate as an old gentleman with mottled hands and watery eyes, our host, diabetic, dying, my double. And here again a digit in Rome's bustle, a phrase as casual as a cape tossed over the shoulder of a dimming pilgrim in an obscure, anonymous altarpiece. Those serene, soft mountains, those tacit gorges, that was Abruzzi. I remembered Abruzzi from A Farewell to Arms with the soft young priest who invites Frederick Henry there after the war. And perhaps Frederick Henry got there. Whether or not, here it was now, the small hill towns on the ridges where it could be infernally cold, the precise, light-defined, bright quarries. It looked incorruptible as the faith of a young priest, its paint still wet. It spun past saying, you swore not to forget fighting and the rattle of gunfire in the mountains, gone without echo, only the tight, fine towns, church tower or spire, the steep rust roofs revolving slowly past the carriage window. We drove through the wet sunlight into Pescara. Wind folded the deck chairs on the esplanade, slamming them shut. A detached striped umbrella somersaulted over the sand. a dish rag sky. Then the weak sunshine strengthened steadily and color came back into the sea's face. The waitress moved among the afternoon tables, setting and straightening the dinner linen. A girl with jet hair, black as her skirt, red mouth and cheeks that were brightening now with the sun and the drying sand. The sky grew Caribbean, the breakers chumbling in from the Adriatic, the folded beach umbrellas like a Chinese army waiting for the drop of the emperor's sword. Through the dirty glass of the hotel in Pescara, a mixture of spume and grime, a quiet like an armistice, the clink like small weapons of cutlery, the rumors darkening like smoke over Albania, the palms on the seafront ceaselessly tossing, the traffic with slow headlights inching through rain. And oh, it was lovely coming through the mountains, castles on the far crests, the flashing olives and the halted infantry of the pines. All the wars were over or far away, but the young woman on the bus, past whose beauty the pines, the olives, and the small castles swept in the clarified window, and whose sadness I thought was like a holiday resort town in the rain, the lights of her gray eyes like glistening traffic, whose name, she told me, was a mountain flowers, but one that was quite common in her country, spoke softly as a drizzle on Pescara's shorefront of Serbia and its sorrow, of the horrors she had seen on the sidewalks of Kosovo, and how it was all war, the fault of the Jews. Yet she said it with calm eye. I learned this later. I learned it from the drizzle and the car lights of Pescara lancing the dark and the folded umbrellas, quiet as banners of the long brown hair that bracketed her face. Leon, Yehuda, Joseph, the war was their fault. But it was lovely coming through the mountains that they said were the Apennines when I asked their names.
Pleasure to be here with my friends. I will brag to you, I will boast to you. Adam Zagajewski's great poem, Going to Lvov, was first published in the United States when I published it in the New Republic, when I was poetry editor at the New Republic. I'll read the first poems in a few of my books, partly because it occurred to me that the first poems, characteristically of me, social or political things tend to sneak in. This is the first poem in my most recent book, Jersey Rain. Samurai Song. When I had no roof, I made audacity my roof. When I had no supper, my eyes dined. When I had no eyes, I listened. When I had no ears, I thought. When I had no thought, I waited. When I had no father, I made care my father. When I had no mother, I embraced order. When I had no friend, I made quiet my friend. When I had no enemy, I opposed my body. When I had no temple, I made my voice my temple. I have no priest. My tongue is my choir. When I have no means, fortune is my means. When I have nothing, death will be my fortune. Need is my tactic. Detachment is my strategy. When I had no lover, I courted my sleep. I'll read to you the first poem in my book, The Want Bomb. It's called From the Childhood of Jesus. From the childhood of Jesus. One Saturday morning, he went to the river to play. He modeled 12 sparrows out of the river clay and scooped a clear pond with a dam of twigs and mud. Around the pond, he set the birds he had made as evenly as the hours. Jesus was 5. He smiled as a child would who had made a little world of clear, still water and clay beside a river. But a certain Jew came by, a friend of his father, and he scolded the child and ran at once to Joseph, saying, "Come see how your child has profaned the Sabbath, making images at the river on the day of rest." So Joseph came to the place and took his wrist and told him, "Child, you have offended the word." Then Jesus freed the hand that Joseph held and clapped his hands and shouted to the birds to go away. They raised their beaks at his words and breathed and stirred their feathers and flew away. The people were frightened. Meanwhile, another boy, the son of Annas the scribe, had idly taken a branch of driftwood and, leaning against it, had broken the dam and muddied the little pond and scattered the twigs and stones. Then Jesus was angry and shouted, "Unrighteous, impious, ignorant, what did the water do to harm you? Now you are going to wither the way a tree does. You shall bear no fruit and no leaves. You shall wither down to the root." At once the boy was all withered. His parents moaned. The Jews gasped. Jesus began to leave, then turned and prophesied, his child's face wet with tears. 12 times 12 times 12 thousands of years before these heavens and this earth were made, the Creator set a jewel in the throne of God with hell on the left and heaven to the right, the sanctuary in front and behind, an endless night endlessly fleeing, a Torah written in flame. And on that jewel in the throne, God wrote, "My name." Then Jesus left and went into Joseph's house. The family of the withered one also left the place, carrying him home. The Sabbath was nearly over. By dusk, the Jews were all gone from the river. Small creatures came from the undergrowth to drink and foraged in the shadows along the bank. Alone in his cot in Joseph's house, the Son of Man was crying himself to sleep. The moon rose higher. The Jews put out their lights and slept, and all was calm and as it had been, except in the agitated household of the scribe, Annas, and high in the dark, where, unknown even to Jesus, the 12 new sparrows flew aimlessly through the night, not blinking or resting, as if never to alight. And I'll close with what I plan to be the first poem of a book I don't think I have quite finished yet. The poem is called Immature Song. I've heard that adolescence is a recent invention, a byproduct of progress, one of capitalism's suspended transitions between one state and another state, like refugee camps, internment camps, like the fields of concentration in a campus catalog, summer camps for teenagers. When I was quite young, my miscomprehension was that concentration camp meant where the scorned were admonished to concentrate, humiliated, forbidden to let the mind wander away. Concentration seemed just the kind of punitive euphemism the adult world would use to coerce, like the word citizenship on the report cards, graded along with disciplines like history, English, mathematics. Citizenship was a field or discipline in which for certain years I was awarded every marking period a D, meaning poor. Possibly my first political emotion was wishing they would call it conduct or deportment. The indefinitely suspended transition of the refugee camps must be a poor kind of refuge, subjected to capricious kindnesses and requirements and brutalities. The unchampioned refugees kept between childhood and adulthood, having neither. In the Holy Land, for example, or in Mother Africa. At that same time of my life, when I heard the abbreviation DP for displaced person, I somehow mixed it up with DTs for delirium tremens, both a kind of stumbling marked by a childish nickname. And you, my poem, you are like an adolescent, confused, awkward, self-preoccupied, vaguely rebellious in a way that lacks practical focus, moving without discipline from thing to thing. Do you disrespect authority merely because it speaks so badly? Because it deploys the lethal bromides with a clumsy conviction that offends your senses? But if called upon to argue such matters as the refugees, you mumble and stammer, poor citizen. You get sullen, you sigh, and you look away.
Good evening. Yeah, it is a pleasure to read with friends. I will start with a poem which I read in both languages, means in English and in Polish. The translator is Claire Kavanagh. It's called Summer's Fullness. In summer, above a mountain stream scented with willows, where purple butterflies, red admirals, and swallowtails, heavy with beauty, perform their final flight above the glittering water and above the glittering alder and above the glittering world, where the air is so drenched in essential oils that you could pour it into glasses and feel its convex lens beneath your fingers. In August, when resin burns above the boughs of pines and pine cones crackle as if licked by tongues of everlasting flame, and a sea authentically blue sways peacefully below like a victor, a king who has conquered the Persians, and all his yachts bow gently with every passing wave, and swimmers, submerged in translucent bedding, move with infinite slowness along invisible lines, along the white threads binding every substance, and to hear the vast whisper of creatures finally content, when it seems that even insects must have their own Dionysus. In August, when Europe's bustle suddenly ceases and factories stop short and tourists laugh loudly on the beaches of the Ligurian Sea, just take two steps behind the scenes, and there a dense grove's semi-darkness may conceal the shadows of those who lived briefly in fear without hope, the shadows of our brothers, our sisters, the shadows of Ravensbrück and Colima, poor angels of a black salvation watching us greedily. This poem is called Watching Shoah in a Hotel Room in America. And I mean Shoah, the documentary by Claude Lanzmann, of course. There are nights as soft as fur on a foal, but we prefer chess or card playing. Here, some hotel guests sing happy birthday as the one-eyed TV nonchalantly shuffles its images. The trees of my childhood have crossed an ocean to greet me coolly from the screen. Polish peasants engage with a Jesuitical zest in theological disputes. Only the Jews are silent, exhausted by their long dying. The rivers of the voyages of my youth flow cautiously over the distant, unfamiliar continent. Hay wagons haul not hay, but her. their axles squeaking under the feathery weight. We are innocent, the pines claim. The SS officers are haggard and old. Doctors struggle to save them, their hearts, lives, consciences. It's late. The insinuations of drowsiness have me. I would sleep, but my neighbors choir happy birthday still louder, louder than the dying Jews. Huge trucks transport stars from the firmament. Gloomy trains go by in the rain. I am innocent, Mozart repents. Only the aspen, as usual, trembles, prepared to confess all its crimes. The Czech Jews sing the national anthem. Where is my home? There is no home. Houses burn. The cold gas whistles within. I grow more and more innocent, sleepy. The TV reassures me. Both of us are beyond suspicion. The birthday is noisier. The shoes of Auschwitz in pyramids high as the sky groan faintly. Alas, we outlived mankind. Now let us sleep, sleep. We have nowhere to go. The last one. It's called My Masters. My masters are not infallible. They are neither Goethe, who had a sleepless night only when distant volcanoes moaned, nor Horace, who wrote in the language of gods and altar boys. My masters seek my advice. In fleecy overcoats, hurriedly slipped on over their dreams, at dawn, when the cool wind interrogates the birds, my masters talk in whispers. I can hear their broken speech. Thank you.
We are moving now to the second part of our evening, hoping that the poets are so wonderful with words also because they are very wise, and therefore they are going to give us some answers to the questions that we are asking. And we are also very lucky that all three poets are each coming from a very different context. Robert Pinsky is an American poet, born in America, writing about America. Derek Walcott is from the West Indies, from the colonial and post-colonial context. And Adam Zagajewski grew up in a communist country that was a satellite of the Soviet Union, an empire that collapsed already. So the first question, we'll be trying to talk about poetry and politics in a kind of a little bit circuitous way. So I would like to ask first, maybe with Derek Walcott, your poetry is very much preoccupied with the issue of empire, actually with the beauty of empire, the beauty and decay of empire. And your friend Joseph Brodsky was writing about empire too. And I don't know, maybe you can, in a way, contrast yourself against it.
Well, my experience of empire, to the anger of a lot of people who are more militant, but I have to talk the truth, is not a severe one. It was not a harsh experience. My experience of empire is benign. My experience of the French Empire, the first time I went to Martinique and I saw gendarmes, white gendarmes in Martinique, I thought, these people are crazy. They are white police officers. They enforce the law. And we are used to, in the British Empire, the British colonies, the law was represented by the constable, who was unarmed. And that has remained for me permanently an example of why the stubbornness of the French led to disasters like Algeria and Dien Bien Phu and whatever else they've led to. Some Frenchmen here perhaps get up and say no. But the display of authority in the French Empire in the Antilles was in the gendarmes. And I was horrified to think that even when I was a grown man, to go to Martinique and see what the law was represented by was horrific for me. So I think that's crucial. I think that the manifestation of justice and equality, if you want, couldn't be borne out by the presence of the gendarmes. And that led, or has led, to the vehemence of French political revolt, intellectual revolt in people like Fanon and so forth. We don't have a Fanon in the English-speaking Caribbean. We have C.L.R. James, but he's not as polemical and, what you call it, as violent in theory as, say, Frantz Fanon is. And that's obvious since the presence of the gendarme is representative of what the empire's rule was. The other thing that is true and can't be denied is whatever you were taught, what you were taught was what the British public school boy was taught. You were taught Shakespeare and Dickens and the classics and stuff like that. And I can't regret that. In fact, I am grateful for that. So that the very easy thing for anyone to say is if you were brought up as a British colonial subject, you were brainwashed. Yeah, but it's okay to be brainwashed by Shakespeare, I think. So I'll just say a couple of things in that respect. We did not have the temptation, the aggravation, in fact, that could surround us in the very emphatic presence of, say, French authority. The French technique was to tell the colonists that they were equal, they were Frenchmen. They were not colonies, they were départements. And that made a great deal of, you know, meant a great deal of privilege to the French citizen, who would be a French citizen, whether he was in Martinique or whether he was in Provence. But what happened was that the départements were left behind. And what you had now was you had independent islands who at one point were colonies who passed Martinique and Guadeloupe in the département definitions and went on to actual adult suffrage and independence.
My empire was not British and it was not even French. It was Soviet. So I have a completely different experience. It was a modern empire and a modern dictatorship which tried to impose everything, the entire vision of the world. One of my friends in the 70s wrote a poem which he called "The Greatest Polish Poet is the State." And this was true. The state, the communist state, had poetic aspirations. The state wanted to decide which metaphors are good, which metaphors are not good. It stopped, the radicalness of this stopped in 1956, but before 1956, there was something like normative aesthetic, which meant that the state defined what kind of music should be composed, what kind of poems should be written, and what kind of paintings should be painted. So it was a very active, aggressive empire and ideological empire. And this was an empire that wanted to compete with poetry. They had their own, it had its own vision of the world. I think the essence of totalitarianism is this inherent conviction of the state, that the state knows better, it knows everything, has an answer to each question. So poetry, and as a young poet, I was irritated by this, and I tried, when I and my friends, we tried to compete with the state, to take away this privilege of the empire, of the state, and to say, well, we have something to say as well in poetry. But that's gone now. But it isn't, for me, an unforgettable experience of a struggle about who's right, who is the greater poet, the state or the poets. And we finally have won, I think, because the state stopped writing poetry.
I suppose that the term empire should frighten Americans or disturb Americans on the model of the classical empires. The Roman Empire was a republic and maintained the vestiges of the republic and the outward forms of the republic long after it had ceased to be a republic. And the Athenian democracy, neither were these, there wasn't a utopia of the Athenian democracy, as I understand. Slaves, women had no rights, etc., but it was a democracy. And in the course of fulfilling their imperial ambitions, they destroyed themselves, and they certainly destroyed the democracy. I guess the besetting sin of empire is complacency. And in the context of being a citizen of an empire, if you think the citizen of a potential empire, I hope we're still somewhat of a democracy and a republic, is to resist the bullying uniformity or complacency. I will tell an anecdote that is behind one of the poems I read to you. I was present on the occasion when Amiri Baraka, someone with whom I always had pretty friendly relations, read what became a celebrated political poem. It was talked about a lot in political pages. He got in a great fight with McGreevy, the governor of New Jersey. It was the poem in which, amongst other threads in the poem, Baraka says the Jews and Israelis were warned to get out of the World Trade Centers. And in what I read about the disputes about that poem, I never read anything that had what was the most striking thing for me as a member of the audience. I think I had read a poem.